You're listening to Midori Howl's first broadcast on the 31st of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Her determination resulted last year in a once unthinkable political deal between Kosovo and Serbia. We had a similar breakthrough last November when she helped broker a deal aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear ambitions.
From the legacy of the EU's outgoing foreign policy chief to Sweden's recognition of Palestine to the somewhat perplexing recruiting prowess of ISIS, we'll discuss the day's top news stories with Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark here in the studio. Also ahead, we'll meet the historian Judith Flanders to talk about her new book, which tries to figure out how, when, and why we started thinking of houses as homes. Later in the show...
Is somebody there?
This thing is haunting us.
Hello?
All of us. So who's next?
How do we stop this?
You have to break the connection, or it will keep coming for you.
Karen Krasanovich will be here for an appropriately spooky cinema review. All that, plus a check-in with our man in DC, and some inevitably Halloween-themed music. So hang a Do Not Disturb sign on the door and tune into Midori House on Monocle 24. A typically action-packed 58 minutes ahead of us, but before all that, Bill Bingham has the world news.
Monocle 24 News, the president of Burkina Faso, Blaise Compaoré, has been ousted following days of protests against efforts to extend his rule. In a statement read out on the country's news and television stations, Mr. Compaoré declared a vacancy of power with a view to allowing free and transparent elections within 90 days. He did not say who would take power until then, but Military Chief General Honoré Traoré has announced he has taken over as head of state. Mr. Compaoré had been in power for 27 years and had been seeking a change in the law to allow him to rule for longer. Paul Melly from Chatham House Policy Institute told us other countries in the region have made more democratic progress.
The old, long-serving authoritarian presidents of the past have mostly gone. And normality is presidents who serve a couple of terms, 8 or 10 years perhaps in power, and then leave office. And people in Burkina Faso clearly feel there is no reason why they too can't have that sort of political system.
Israel has decided to reopen Jerusalem's access to Temple Mount in Old Jerusalem hours after ordering its closure. The area, which includes the Al-Aqsa Mosque, contains sites holy to Muslims and Jews and was shut by Israel following the shooting of a Jewish activist. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas had condemned the closure as a declaration of war. Muslim men have been restricted to those over 50 years because of fears of unrest at Friday prayers. There'll be no restrictions on Muslim women. 12 miners have been killed in a flooded underground coal mine in northeastern Colombia. Flooding in the mine in the Amaga municipality and in Antioquia happened on Thursday afternoon. Rescue workers say a breach in a subterranean water source during mining activities appears to have caused the flooding. The region has seen several mining accidents in recent years. Russian gas giant Gazprom says it could restore supplies to Ukraine as early as next week if Kiev pays $2.2 billion worth of debts and prepayments. A deal to resume supplies was brokered by the EU during talks in Brussels. Jan Randolph, director of sovereign risk at IHS Global Insight, says the deal is good news for Ukraine, which still needs support.
Ukraine's been kept on a very tight financial leash, just like Greece. So effectively, the payment of the gas will be through the bailout. And that's the IMF in the first instance, but also the European and the American bilateral loans, which is contingent on the IMF sticking in there with the Ukraine.
A judge in Maine in northeast USA has ordered a quarantine for nurse Casey Hickox, who defied her Ebola isolation in a tense standoff with state authorities. District Court Chief Judge Charles Laverdiere has ordered the nurse, who had recently returned from treating Ebola patients in Sierra Leone, to submit to what he called direct active monitoring. He also said she should not appear in public places such as shopping centres or cinemas, except to receive necessary health care. She's allowed to go walking or jogging, but she must maintain a 3-foot distance from people. Members of Myanmar's government, opposition, military and ethnic groups have held roundtable discussions in preparation for next year's election. The rare talks come before a visit by US President Barack Obama to the country in December. Discussion has been focused on peace and political reform. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for 18:06 in London. We'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:06, which is 13:06 in New York City, I think. Or is it that annoying time of year when it's 14:06? It is. It's that annoying time of year when it's 14:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the day's news is the journalist Mary Dejewski, the chief editorial writer and columnist at The Independent, and Phil Clark, a reader in international politics at SOAS here in London. Welcome both back to the programme. We will start with Sweden's recognition of Palestine, which became official yesterday. Sweden isn't the first country to have recognised Palestine. If I've done my maths right, it's the 135th. It's not even the first EU country. It's the 8th. But it is the first EU country in Western Europe, which does seem kind of a broach of the divide which usually arrays Western Europe in America's corner on this issue. Mary, I'll ask you first, does this really make any difference to anything? I mean, if you've already got 134 countries recognising you and you still don't really have a country, is the 135th going to tip the balance?
Well, from my perspective, I don't think it does. But it's seen differently in Sweden, which thinks that it's a huge departure and it's incredibly enlightened. It's, as you say, it's the first West European country to recognise Palestine as a state. And it also seems to have been taken very amiss in Israel itself. So to that extent, it looks as though it sort of does matter.
On that point, Phil, about the degree to which Israel has taken it amiss, as Mary put it, and indeed they have. They have recalled their ambassador to Stockholm, which they actually, if you're going to get recalled from Stockholm, this would be the time of year, in fairness. They have recalled their ambassador to Stockholm, which they obviously don't do for everywhere that recognises Palestine, because that wouldn't leave them with much of a diplomatic service. Why is Israel so upset about this?
I think Israel feels that it's one thing to lose peripheral countries that don't have too much diplomatic clout, that they seem here to be losing a country that has substantial diplomatic interest, that has financial interest. And I guess there's a sense that the Swedes are often on the side of international morality. So having them say these kind of things about Palestine perhaps resonates a little bit further than some other countries. I mean, I did like the comments today by the Israeli foreign minister saying that the Swedes couldn't possibly understand this because the situation is much more complicated than putting together flat pack furniture from IKEA.
Avigdor Lieberman's obviously an awful lot more proficient with IKEA furniture
exactly.
than I am.
Right?
I have had moments surrounded by slot F and screw B where I've been thinking, yeah, give me the Middle East over this any day of the week. Mary, the reality though is, isn't it? I've spent some time in the West Bank and Gaza myself, not for a while though, but the reality has always struck me on the ground that however many people say we like the idea of a Palestinian state or we recognise a Palestinian state, it really is kind of up to Israel whether one really ever exists and to what extent it exists, isn't it?
Well, it is, as you say, kind of up to Israel, but it's also kind of up to the Palestinians as well, because they haven't shown... Okay, there are huge disadvantages to being where the different bits of Palestine are and to having Israel as a neighbour and to having the whole question of the right of return and the refugee problem. Having said all that, the Palestinians really haven't done themselves any favours by how difficult they've found it to govern themselves and to enforce a degree of security. And you can ask which came first, the insecurity or the difficulties with governing. But the end result is that Palestine at the moment, the Palestinians simply do not look capable of governing a viable state.
On which subject, Phil, is it even accurate at this point, certainly in the last few years, to think of Palestine as one state, of the West Bank and Gaza even being one country, or have we sort of ended up de facto in a state where there is in effect an East Palestine and a West Palestine?
I mean, I think we saw that even in the recent conflict, that there was real divisions within the Palestinian government, that there were these huge kind of internal divisions. That there's another sort of realm in which this whole problem has kind of come to a head, which is about Palestine and the International Criminal Court, because I think a lot of people were hoping that Palestine might send its criminal cases to the ICC so that Israel could be held accountable. But actually, Palestine couldn't get its act together on that. There was massive internal divisions around that. And also, this issue of Palestinian statehood, in fact, increases the pressure on Palestine to perhaps send cases to the ICC. Palestine's not very happy about having to do that at the moment, because they're a little bit worried that they themselves might also be held accountable for various war crimes. So the issue of statehood is difficult. Internal divisions are there, and also the ramifications of what happens if you're too recognized as a state. You're expected to do certain things in the international community, and that might not necessarily work out in Palestine's favor.
You are kind of expected to behave like a grown-up, aren't you?
Indeed.
Mary, what I'm struggling to understand myself here is what might be in this for Sweden, really. I mean, apart from the, obviously they will endure a certain amount of earache from Avigdor Lieberman, which is not a small factor to take on board when making a decision. But are they just trying to look like nice guys, or is this a genuine stand on principle, or are there commercial interests at play?
I mean, personally, I don't think there are particularly commercial interests at play. I wouldn't rule out it simply being a matter of Sweden thinking they will do this on principle because it's a good thing and rather a sort of Swedish-Scandinavian thing to do. It's interesting that when was it, a couple of weeks ago, the debate in the UK Parliament about recognising a Palestinian state, and this was acclaimed by everybody who listened to it, really, said this was an absolutely fantastic debate. It was a really classy debate. And everybody voted by a huge majority to recognise Palestinian statehood. But this was never going to happen. It was never going to go the further step that Great Britain would actually recognise Palestinian statehood, whereas in Sweden, you can actually do that.
Just a final thought on this, Phil, and I don't like to apply the phrase can of worms to obviously a group of human beings with quite reasonable aspirations, but Palestine is far from the only aspiring state in the world that seeks its own independence, but it's the big ticket item. It's the one around which all these concerns do centre. Is there a concern that if the world says, okay, fine, Palestine, you get your own state, then all of a sudden there is this global clamour of people saying, well, what about us?
Yeah, and we live in a very strange international time where fragmentation is suddenly an issue. And we've seen this in Scotland, we've seen this in South Sudan, we've seen this in Ukraine. And I mean, 10 years ago, we would have been having a very different type of discussion. There were very fewer concerns around secession and the kind of splitting apart of nations. We don't live in that era any longer. I mean, Catalonia, I guess, is another case. I mean, we live in a time where states are very, very worried about subnational groups gaining legitimacy, gaining power, and seeking to go their own way. So I think that's undoubtedly affecting a lot of these international discussions at the moment.
Well, all that considered, as we move along, Catherine Ashton, the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, may think she's happened upon a felicitous weekend to retire. The British politician and diplomat steps down this weekend after 5 years to be replaced by the former Italian Foreign Minister, Federica Mogherini. We will hear now how Catherine Ashton has been seen in Brussels and what she might be remembered for. This is our Brussels correspondent, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson.
Whoever it was who got that position as the first head of the European External Action Service in 2009, they were never going to have an easy ride. This was a new foreign affairs post in a bloc where an awful lot of the member states were deeply suspicious of having an EU foreign service and quite unwilling to sacrifice their own foreign policy clout and their own national interests overseas. But when Baroness Ashton was named to the post, she came in for particular criticism, at first over her utter lack of foreign policy experience. The criticism at times became quite personal and arguably sexist, with the French media even commenting on the way she dressed. In many ways, that set the combative tone with the press for her whole tenure. She very rarely gave any interviews and is very guarded at press conferences and only answers a few questions. So the feeling in Brussels is that she generally has not been very good at communicating what the EAS has been doing. And I think it's fair to say that the press corps here won't miss her very much at all. There have also been some quite critical reports by auditors in the European Parliament, who summarised in a report last year that the EEAS was top-heavy and encumbered in its decision-making by layers of bureaucracy. So it definitely was a very shaky start for Baroness Ashton. But over the last year, I would say there has been some sea change in opinion in her brand of diplomacy, with some notable foreign policy successes. Her determination resulted last year in a once unthinkable political deal between Kosovo and Serbia. We had a similar breakthrough last November when she helped broker a deal aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear ambitions. This earned her plaudits from people like British Foreign Secretary William Hague and US Secretary of State John Kerry. Even Britain's Telegraph newspaper, not a natural ally of hers, ran a blog entitled, "We Were All Wrong About Baroness Ashton." So the verdict is definitely mixed. She won few friends in Brussels with her guarded approach, but there was finally some grudging acknowledgement that perhaps she was better behind closed doors.
Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson there in Brussels on the departing EU foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton. Mary, as Charlotte was recalling there, when she was first appointed to the job, there was certainly a continent-wide chorus, and especially in this country, a nationwide chorus of who? Has she proved her detractors wrong, do we think, in her 5 years on the job?
I tend to think that she has proved a lot of her detractors wrong. I don't think she was necessarily maligned at the beginning. I mean, as Charlotte said, it was a new job and she had to start it. And really,
I don't think people knew enough about her to malign her.
They did, because they immediately jumped to conclusions because of what they felt she looked like and she sounded like, and because of her lack of experience as they saw it in the area. For her, I think a crucial thing that I think was a pity and maybe didn't make her the best choice, which is to appoint a British citizen who has no foreign languages to that job, so that when they go up against, as it were, the Brussels press and the Brussels bureaucracy, they actually can't string two words together. It doesn't matter to me whether it's in French or German or Spanish or anyone, Lithuanian, it doesn't matter. But the impression given is that she's British, she's insular, she doesn't know anything, and she's going to be no good in Brussels. Now, I think a lot of those things were actually untrue, that she turned out actually to be quite good in Brussels in a rather low-key, behind-the-scenes way. But I think that the Kosovo agreement and the prelude to the Iran agreement, both of these were actually huge achievements that I think her successor may actually find it difficult to replicate.
Phil, she was the second person to hold the job properly, at least, after Javier Solana. Has the European Union, do you think, figured out what this job actually is yet? It does still seem like a weird thing, possibly at least to me. I mean, another great British statesperson, Palmerston, famously said that nations have no permanent friends or permanent enemies, only permanent interests. Can you say the same of a continent?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult, and it's difficult to have a British leader in that kind of position doing that kind of job at a time of real European antagonism towards Britain and vice versa. So I think that Baroness Ashton also absorbed a lot of the antagonism that the UK generally was kind of experiencing in Brussels at that time. For all of her kind of quiet work behind the scenes, she'd have a tendency to kind of put her head above the parapet from time to time. I mean, she was quite vocal on the Israel situation, another key figure who's received all sorts of negative reactions in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And I guess she'll also go down as someone who stepped up in Kiev during the protest and kind of ruffled Russian feathers very early on. And I think in some ways became this kind of target in Moscow, seen as the person who was kind of representing the EU and European interest as Ukraine tried to take a more European direction. So I guess, she was quite a volatile person.
On that subject, Mary, she's been given quite a lot of credit, and I suspect quite rightly, for getting Serbs and Kosovars around a table and negotiating with each other in a more or less civil fashion, which is no small diplomatic accomplishment. But that had been a semi-frozen situation which had existed for some time, whereas Ukraine, as Phil just mentioned, was a crisis that whirled up out of almost nowhere and gave almost nobody any time to think at all. How do you assess her response to that challenge?
I think she was in a hugely difficult situation because, in a way, this was something that the European Union had almost created, as you say, out of nothing, because it was relations with the European Union and the Trade Association Agreement.
Which were the very cause of the whole thing.
Exactly. But it wasn't Baroness Ashton who'd had anything to do with that. It was the commissioners who were responsible for enlargement, and it was foreign ministers, especially of Poland, some of the Scandinavians, and the countries bordering on Ukraine, who were desperate to have this agreement. And so she really was parachuted into Kiev in an attempt to help try and clear up something, in a way, that the European Union, different bits of the European Union, had themselves created. And I'm not sure that she was actually too successful at it. I think one of the reasons why maybe she's taken less blame, whether in Moscow than anywhere else, for what went on in Kiev, for the failed diplomacy in Kiev, is because the Americans were so much more clumsy and attracted so much more the wrath of the Russians.
We are going to take a short break now. It's coming up for 18:21 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, joined by Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark, who will both still be here when we return. We will be looking ahead at Burkina Faso and Russia, and we'll also be wondering why so many young men seem so keen to volunteer as foot soldiers for the Islamic State.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are the journalist Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark from SOAS. Now, for about 13 years or so, it has been accepted wisdom in some circles that militant Islamism has been caused by foreigners meddling in Middle Eastern wars, which are nothing to do with them. A new UN report confirms that ever larger of numbers of Westerners are expressing their outrage by volunteering to meddle in Middle Eastern wars, which have nothing to do with them. It claims that at least 15,000 people from 80 countries have travelled to Syria and Iraq to fight with ISIS and other similar inclined organisations. Phil, how much of this phenomenon is just, frankly, thick young men being thick?
I think that's part of it. I think there clearly is a cohort of young men who are available for recruit. What's interesting to me is that other groups operating in the Middle East, like Al-Qaeda, have sought this kind of international involvement in the past and have failed. So it suggests that, at the very least, IS's recruitment policy is much more effective. What's also interesting, I think, is how widespread this is, that it's not just coming from a handful of European states. It's actually coming from right across the globe. It's coming from the US. It's coming from Canada. As Australia has even expressed in the last couple of weeks, there are large numbers of Australians travelling there too. So this is a genuinely international phenomenon. Which I would imagine also perhaps poses some challenges for IS in absorbing all of these very international ranks, this very unruly group of young men coming from 80 different countries. How do you cobble them together into any kind of effective force and kind of think that you can take on the Iraqi state or the Syrian government or these others? So challenges for international governments, but I would imagine in the long run also a challenge for IS here.
Well, one would certainly hope so. Mary, what vaguely occurs to me is, like, having surveyed the sum of the outpourings of these young foot soldiers, who do strike me as a collection of slightly insular, whining, entitled dimbulbs who remind me of nothing so much as reality show contestants. I'm just wondering how much of the appeal of this is to do with the fact that 10, 15 years ago, if you ran away to a foreign war to entertain yourself in your late adolescence by, you know, beheading peasant soldiers in someone else's army, you couldn't disseminate photos of yourself doing that to the rest of the world, whereas now you do get to star in your own little action hero movie.
Well, I think that works the other side as well, because it means that not only can you get your pictures out, but you get to hear about these things by seeing other people's pictures. So I think the extent to which, as it were, there is almost advertising going on, plus the fact that international communications, not just in that sort of way, but, you know, being able to get on a plane and go somewhere like that, all these things are just much easier now than they were even 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. So I think there's a lot of that in it. I think there's also an extent, you know, a lot of countries have abolished conscription, and they don't have sort of volunteer services for young people leaving school or going through higher education. And I think there is a sense that this is something actually quite interesting and challenging to do. And if you don't have something like that, then there will be people who will see this as infinitely preferable, either in the UK to going on the dole, or working in a really boring job, going to a call centre or whatever. So I can sort of understand why people might want to do it.
Okay, well, let's look briefly now at a couple of stories in which you both have a personal interest. First, Burkina Faso, where rusted-on President Blaise Compaoré appears to have badly overplayed his hand by proposing to extend his term, which had already lasted from shortly after the earth cooled until the present day. His ungrateful people burnt down his parliament, and whatever Compaoré's other shortcomings, he can, it seems, take a hint. He's resigned. Phil, you grew up more or less in the vicinity of Burkina Faso. Are you surprised by what's occurred?
I'm very surprised. I grew up all through my teenage years in a little village on the Ghana-Burkina Faso border, and Compaoré was a fixture, and I don't think anyone could have imagined that this man would leave. I mean, what's interesting to me in the Burkina Faso events of the last couple of days is that, to a certain extent, that this is the final phase of the Arab Spring. In 2010 and 2011, when things were exploding in places like Tunisia and Libya, Compaoré was one of the first African heads of state to react very, very quickly. And what he did was he sacked several cabinet ministers. He set up a commission to try and deal with unruliness in the countryside. He tried to deal with economic development. He was trying to react to the kind of concerns that were being expressed by the bulk of the population. So he was trying to kind of safeguard himself against the kind of thing that was happening in North Africa. And then I think by the 2012 and 2013, a lot of people thought that Compaoré had done this quite well. He had kind of seen off the opposition, he'd seen off the protest. What this shows now, I think, is that that kind of discontent is really, really deep, and that the people will not be easily bought off in the way that he had hoped, and he's paid the price for that.
Mary, that the likening Phil made there to this to the popular revolts we saw in North Africa in 2011, does this strike you as the kind of thing that could spread? I mean, West Africa is not a region which wants for similar quasi-tyrannies. One thinks of Cameroon or Chad or Equatorial Guinea or others.
I find it difficult to see it spreading much further. But what strikes me about this, and though it's slightly cruel to say, because obviously there's a lot of people tied up in this whose lives could be extremely made extremely bad by what's happening, but it is a classic sort of military coup of a sort that we haven't seen actually for years and years and years. You suddenly think this is how it always used to be. People go out in the street, there's tumult, they burn down parliament, the president said, yes, I can cope. Military comes in and says, yes, no, you can't, takes over. President has another little go to try and get back, fails, and the military takes over. And that's where we are now.
So while Compaoré stuffs presumably as much of the national treasury as he can into his holdall and researches bolt hole locations, we shall move along to Russia, where... Well, there's a certain amount of reassurance now, I think, that if it ever actually does get cold this winter, 23 degrees on Halloween in London, the people of Europe need not fret that they will need to burn their furniture to keep their houses warm. Russia and Ukraine, despite being more or less at war, have concluded a deal to keep supplying the EU with gas. Mary, is this basically commerce trumping all other concerns, or is this Ukraine and Russia trying to find a way to deal with each other?
I think it's a bit of both. It's convenient for both sides to try and do a bit of dealing with each other. But I think it's also actually not even a genuine commercial deal, but it's also in both sides' interests, because although everybody sort of assumes that Russia's sitting on its gas and says, well, to Ukraine, well, if you don't pay, then that's too bad when you're going to be cold this winter, it's much more complicated than that, because Russia needs to send its gas to Ukraine and through the Ukrainian pipelines. Otherwise, it's not getting any revenue from what is one of its chief exports. This is a two-sided thing. And what Russia, I think, fears and is justified in fearing is that since the last cutoff, which I think was 2009, the European Union, amazingly to everybody, has actually got its act rather spectacularly together. And that even if Ukraine were to have been cut off this winter, neither Ukraine nor the peripheral countries were actually going to freeze, because all sorts of things have happened. Reverse flows have been facilitated. Ukrainians and others have been convinced to use much less energy. Everything is actually turning out much better than it looks. So Russia really needed a deal just as much as everybody else did.
Final, very brief thought on this, if you will, Phil, on exactly that thought. Of the EU and Russia, who is bluffing who here?
Yeah, and I wonder whether Baroness Ashton was involved in this kind of latest exchange at all. I mean, I think there's enormous brinkmanship going on both sides. My sense is we'll need to see in the next 2 or 3 weeks what this kind of means. I mean, are we also going to see a political change off the back of this kind of commercial interaction? I think that's the kind of the long-term issue that we need to look at. I think Mary's absolutely right. People still have to be paid, and that includes inside Russia. This has also shown Putin's heavy reliance on Gazprom and other financial interests like that. Whether this translates into a political change is something that we'll be watching very closely, I would imagine.
Phil Clark from SOAS, Mary Dujewski from The Independent, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Berlin,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll catch up with our man in Washington. We will look at the making of Home with the author and historian Judith Flanders. And then we'll have a Halloween-themed film review to round things off. But ahead of all that, Bill Bingham has the headlines.
The main story is President of Burkina Faso, Blaise Compaoré, has been ousted following days of protest against efforts to extend his rule. In a statement read out on the country's news and television stations, Mr. Compaoré declared a vacancy of power with a view to allowing free and transparent elections within 90 days. Israel has decided to reopen access to Temple Mount in Old Jerusalem, hours after ordering its closure. The area, which includes the Al-Aqsa Mosque, contains sites holy to Muslims and Jews, and was shut by Israel following the shooting of a Jewish activist. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas had condemned the closure as a declaration of war. 12 miners have been killed in a flooded underground coal mine in northeastern Colombia. Flooding in the mine in the Amarga municipality in Antioquia happened on Thursday afternoon. Rescue workers say a breach in a subterranean water source caused the flooding. A judge in Maine in northeast USA has ordered a quarantine for nurse Casey Hickox, who defied her Ebola isolation in a tense standoff with state authorities. The judge said she should not appear in public places such as shopping centres or cinemas except to receive necessary health care. Members of Myanmar's government, opposition, military and ethnic groups have held roundtable discussions in preparation for next year's election. The rare talks come before a visit by US President Barack Obama to the country in December. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House, 2133 in Moscow, 1833 here in London, and by the time I finish this time check, it will almost be 1434 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Washington, D.C., where our correspondent Sasha Eisenberg awaits. Sasha, first of all, a story which has been an absolute treat for those of us who do enjoy a good, you know, infighting media dust-up.
I hope nobody's listening who doesn't enjoy that. Pierre Omidyar, who's the former eBay founder, who has helped sort of build this new media empire around Glenn Greenwald in light of the Snowden revelations, this First Look Media, which has Greenwald's site, the Intercept, and was supposed to have a series of other online magazines, is like slowly erupting, but with the sort of radical transparency that that at least I guess gets some points for like moral consistency. It seems rather predictably that this millionaire who had some idealistic notion of getting a bunch of renegade journalists together to make mayhem with their journalism has proven entirely incapable of actually managing an organization with them. And so Matt Taibbi, who is the sort of former Rolling Stone writer who's most famous for skewering Goldman Sachs, and would probably be one of the last people I would choose to run anything, has left as editor of a magazine that never published a word. And his now former colleagues have written what seems like, you know, thousands of them explaining in much detail what went down, and it seems like everybody's mad at everybody.
It is a shame, because I am one of those people who, speaking as a big fan of Matt Taibbi's writing, was looking forward to seeing what he might do if given a magazine to be let loose with. As far as we can tell, or as far as anybody understands, what now happens to First Look Media, and what now happens to the magazine that Taibbi was supposed to be editing?
So it's not clear that the magazine that Taibbi was going to run, called Racket, which is going to be focused on the finance industry, will go on without him. He made some hires. That said, it appeared like it was very much sort of created in his image. The other parts of First Look Media, I mean, Greenwald and Laura Poitras are and Jeremy Scahill are there, and they are publishing stuff online, and some of it sort of, a good deal of it seems, sort of continued downstream from the Snowden records that they have. That seems to go on. So I think part of it is the question of how will it all be branded online, but broadly, the way that piece was written made it seem like there was great dissatisfaction over Omidyar and some of the sort of media executives that he had brought in to manage this enterprise. That makes me wonder, you know, how long they could possibly keep up working for him.
Well, moving along to a more straightforward political story, if a rather sadder one, Boston is mourning the passing of its long-serving mayor, Tom Menino. Why is he being so fondly remembered?
He was an incredibly long-serving mayor by U.S. standards, 20 years as head of Boston, and presided over an era starting in the early 90s where Boston not only cleaned up and became more sort of governable, but got past some really ugly racial tribal divides that had separated it. Boston had always been stuck in a deep tension between the sort of patrician Protestant elite, the sort of Harvard of Boston, and the Irish Boston, Catholic Protestant, upstairs downstairs in many respects, and then in a way that spilled over into basically everybody making it a miserable place for black people. And Menino came to office as a totally mediocre-seeming city politician, but managed through through charisma and I think a lot of patience to build a political coalition and a governing coalition that brought sort of all those groups together under one umbrella and unified organized labor in the business community. And Boston feels like a far more modern, more globally minded, less tribal city than it did 25 years ago. And I think Menino deserves a lot of credit for that.
Just finally, Sasha, and relatively briefly on the subject of mayoralties, Los Angeles has been having difficulty getting anybody interested in voting for theirs.
Yeah, just about every mayoral election has really low turnout. That, you know, new mayor of New York was elected with basically less than a fifth of the city's residents. And so Los Angeles City Council is thinking about moving their elections to coincide with presidential elections with the idea that, you know, you may end up getting half the people at least participating in the decision of who will run their city.
Sasha Eisenberg in Washington, D.C., thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we will be looking at the history of the home.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, and pretty much everyone listening to Midori House doubtless thinks of where they live as an idiosyncratic expression of their very selves, as unique to them as their fingerprints. The truth is that, fundamentally, our homes are all pretty much alike. There's things to sit, sleep and wash in, things to cook with, and stuff hanging on the walls. It is the contention of our next guest, however, that even the idea that our home is somehow more than a house is a reasonably recent one. Judith Flanders, author of The Making of Home, joins me now. Judith, you look mostly at the last 300 or 400 years of home life. And it occurred to me to wonder what you would think, aside from the obvious electronic stuff, if a visitor from the 17th century dropped round one of our homes now, what would surprise them?
Well, I think you'd start with us, that we have great teeth and we're almost naked.
And some of us have lived past the age of 30.
And some of us are not old haggard crones at 30. But really what is so different is the size of our houses, the fact that there are rooms for each of us that we call our own, that we don't all live in one room and sleep there and eat there and do absolutely everything else there, including washing and other things that if you're having dinner, I won't tell you about now.
This is something you mentioned in the book, because it's not just that now that some of us have our own rooms, some of us, in fact, increasing numbers of us, have our own homes, which I guess even a few generations ago would have been seen as somewhat perverse.
It's positively freakish. I mean, if you read those sort of 1950s post-war novels, you know, unmarried people lived in rooms. You know, they rented a room. Nobody lived singly in a whole house. And this whole thing, I mean, you know, the idea of privacy is, if you will excuse me as a historian, relatively new, only about 400 or 500 years, you know.
A blip,
you know, I turned around yesterday and it was over.
But, a foible.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, the invention of the corridor, we don't think about corridors as something to be invented, but until you invent it, to get from one room to the next, you had to walk through all the other rooms. You can't be private if you have to do that.
So where and when did the idea that a house was, if you will, a home start?
Well, I think it comes with urbanization. So until most people lived in cities, you didn't have this sense of this place being a special place. The whole village belongs to everybody, or the agrarian settlement. You don't need to have this sense of privacy from strangers.
Is that something that varies significantly, though, from modern culture to modern culture, even though most of the Western world now does have this idea of our home as our castle, if you will? But there are places where I guess that desire for privacy, reclusiveness, or indeed not to deal with one's neighbours is more pronounced than others, he said, speaking as a Londoner.
I think so. I mean, my notion is that the development of the idea of home is one of Northwestern Europe. So the area of the Industrial Revolution, the area of Protestantism, the area of lousy weather. Well, it's all got something to do with it. I mean, would you rather be in a market square in Milan or in a market square in Oslo? In November.
Climate is always a huge driver of culture. I mean, I grew up in Australia where you are much more inclined to know who your neighbours are because you spend much more time outside and are therefore much more likely to interact with
them. And of course, Australia is very interesting because you've got that interaction of the very good weather with the culture that is primarily drawn from the Anglo tradition of lousy weather and therefore being inside.
Did researching the book make you, I mean, it must have done. Did you end up looking at your own home in a completely different way?
Well, I think it was discovering things like corridors had to be invented. You know, you never think about that. And then there's all the mythology, the ideas that we've got, things like, you know, the notion of the black and white Tudor facades, meaning sort of Merry England, discovering that actually in the Tudor period, that's not what the buildings looked like.
Well, but on that subject, it just strikes me, not that I'm a hugely assiduous reader of interior decor magazines.
You shock me.
Which, I mean, and really, you'd be even less surprised if you actually saw where I lived. But there is always this weird, there's this kind of bucolic nostalgia about them. I'm not really sure what it is they think they're recreating, but do you think it's nostalgia for a time that never actually occurred?
Definitely for a time that never was. It's for our collective past. One of the most interesting things I found was that those 17th century Dutch pictures, Vermeer, De Hoogh, all of those painters, that's not what the houses of 17th century Amsterdam or Leiden or Delft looked like. Those pictures are totally imaginary. And yet in the 19th century, they were rediscovered. And now to us, they say home.
I mean, the thing you mentioned about corridors is interesting, and just the way that we have adapted, especially in a country with a lot of old architecture like Britain, where we now have, I guess, modern homes in very old houses. I have one myself. I live in a house which I think is actually older than the country I was born in, which is a weird thought. And so obviously it's an adaptation, and indeed in many respects an absolute struggle. Did you end up sort of thinking? Because so much of it, we do have to compromise with what's already there. If we were starting homes from scratch, what would we do differently, do you think?
Well, I think one of the very interesting things is how modernism did not really succeed.
This was Le Corbusier's machine for living.
Which is all about appearance. It's all about what we see, not how we use what we see. And that's why nobody really took to it. And when I say nobody, I mean, you know, 98% of the population. We've picked out some nice things from modernism. We like the big glass windows, or we like, you know, the open plan, but we don't like everything. And it's because modernism takes away privacy. It takes away all the stuff we've built up over the last couple of hundred years. And instead, we return to these, as you say, very old houses, which are surprisingly flexible and surprisingly adaptable to modern life.
But there also seems to be there, and you know, I will admit to this myself, I don't like the idea of living in a completely new building. I like the idea of inhabiting somewhere with an obviously spurious idea of character to it. But it's what people put in their houses, I guess, is a relatively new thing as well. If the idea of home, which and the way that we make it our home, the stuff people put in houses, for whose benefit is that? Do we put that stuff in there for ourselves or to impress other people who we may persuade over our hearth?
I suspect we put it there for ourselves, but one of the interesting things is how precisely the period of stuff from the Industrial Revolution on is the period of home. They go hand in hand, and it's stuff that makes homes.
On that thought, I think we have defined an entire new age there, the age of stuff. And if that isn't a book title, I've never heard one. It's really all yours for free. I'd be honoured. Judith Flanders, author of The Making of Home, available now. Thank you very much for joining us. Time now for some music on Midori House. It is, of course, Halloween. See if you can guess what we're going to play. I'll give you a hint. We did the Michael Jackson one last year. Oh, you know that what that was, and you know why we played it. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now for our daily arts review. It is Halloween, as you may or may not have noticed. It's nearly 7 o'clock. You are probably already under siege from ghastly snot-smeared infants on a sugar high. But we are talking about film with Karen Krasanovich, regular Monocle film critic, and we are trying to talk about suitably spooky films. We're starting with Ouija.
We are.
Yeah. Is it spooky?
It is. It's formulaic, but it is scary. It tries to take you. Well, it's exactly.
How formulaic is it? Do we have a guy in a hockey mask with a chainsaw and scared students going, "I know, let's all hide in the basement"?
Well, we've got the student part.
We've got
a cute, a gorgeous blonde who kills herself. I'm not ruining too much here.
Okay.
and her friend wants to communicate to her through a Ouija board. Now, I don't know about you, but as a child, I was told not to play with a Ouija board, so I never have, because apparently you can reach the other world.
See, I never did that as a child because I was annoyingly skeptical even then and just remember thinking, well, that's not going to work, is it?
Well, no, but it looks like a big plectrum, so I'm surprised that you didn't like it. But anyway, this is directed by a guy, a special effects guy for the Stan Winston Studio. He's done special effects for Sixth Sense, Stiles White. It's got some very solid production values. It's slick. It knows when to make a lot of noise. It's not going to be unpredictable, but you will jump.
Okay, we have a clip of that. Let's see if it makes us jump.
Come on, you guys. Who's doing that? Sarah, cut it out.
I'm not pushing it.
Just spelled hi, friend.
Hey, this is freaking me out. I'm done with this.
Jimmy found the board in her house. She woke something up.
Is somebody there?
This thing, it's haunting us.
Hello?
It's coming through all of us. So who's next?
How do we stop this?
You have to break the connection, or it will keep coming for you.
Ouija, it does sound terrifically silly.
Yeah, it is. It's silly in as much as most horror films are.
Yeah. Is it knowingly formulaic? Does the film basically admit, yeah, we're doing a thing here, it's a horror film, you know how this goes?
Yeah. It's not going to give you anything innovative. There's no innovation here. But the production values are really good. It's slick, it's in focus, the lighting is nice, the sound effects are pretty good. And, you know, you're going to sit there with your friends and you're all going to feel smart. So, there.
Oh, so it gives the audience that whole kind of arch-knowing superiority thing.
Yeah, I would say
I'm a huge fan of that feeling.
Well, you see, and also it turns into a haunted house movie, so you get two horror films in one.
There okay, that's fine. I'll sign up for that. The Remaining.
Yes, The Remaining. Now, that's out in a couple weeks. This is sort of, you know, there's all sorts of different kind of horror, you know, psychological horror, political horror, horror. That's a pure horror. This is religious horror.
Okay.
This is there's a wedding. This is actually made by the executive producer of Donnie Darko, which I think is very interesting. It's a wedding, a Christian wedding, and the apocalypse hits, the rapture hits, and the bride's parents are taken to heaven.
That would mess up the catering.
But this would be a mess because demons love cake. We know this. And the daughter and the new groom have to run for their life from demons and reassess their relationship with God.
The rapture hits literally as they're getting married.
Yes,
God, that is rotten timing.
It's not good.
That is.
And you thought
poor.
Throwing rice was bad.
Well, I know. People complain when it rains.
But the thing is, it's actually a nicely made film. It's quite unusual. There was a movie called The Rapture quite a few years ago now. And you know, we have a tendency to think, well, if we're not Christians or if we're not interested in this, this isn't worth seeing. But actually, this film is made on the kind of, Walking Dead, Final Destination sort of structure. And it tells a good story, and it's quite entertaining.
You mentioned governmental horror there in your list of categories of horror, and you have a film of that ilk, you believe.
Yes, and I think that this is probably going to win its director, Laura Poitras, an Oscar. She was Oscar nominated before for her documentary, The Oath. The Citizen Four, it's a documentary about Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, but the actual moment when he was revealing these the NSA documents, the secret documents they were saying that they didn't have. And it proves basically that the American government, if not all governments, spy on all of us all the time. And when I say spy, I mean that they are using, I don't want to say quantum mathematics, but you know what I mean. They are taking all of this data from everything, wherever you go, wherever you buy, wherever you hang out, all this data from all your devices and building basically a massive database.
Did it inspire you in you an urge to sort of retreat to the woods with a large supply of tin goods and a shotgun?
I went out and bought a lot of foil to make a hat. no, but it did. I mean, in a way, because these had already made headlines already. I mean, this is about maybe 6 months ago, and they're showing you basically what happened. It took her a while to cut this together. We already know what he leaked. And we know that he's in Russia now, so.
We have a clip of Citizen 4.
For now, know that every border you cross, every purchase you make, every call you dial, every cell phone tower you pass, friend you keep, site you visit, and subject line you type is in the hands of a system whose reach is unlimited, but whose safeguards are not. In the end, if you publish the source material, I will likely be immediately implicated.
Clip from Citizen 4, there, Laura Poitras's documentary about Edward Snowden, the third choice of our guest film critic, Karen Krasanovich. Karen, we've got a few seconds left. If people were going to go and see a film this weekend, not necessarily a horror one, and Lord knows the government probably already knows which films we're going to go and see, I guess. But if we're playing our parts as hapless drones in this giant matrix, what will we be going to?
Well, I would say if you haven't seen The Babadook, please do, because it is horror, but it's psychological horror. It's beautifully made and it's surprising.
Okay.
It's really superb. There's also Mr. Turner, which is the Mike Leigh movie about the painter Turner, which is, I can
you,
see.
You lost me at Mike Leigh movie.
Got that. You know, I'm not usually a huge fan, but this is quite, it's painter Leigh, of course, and it's also quite, it's got a lot of stagecraft. It's quite beautiful. So if you don't want any horror, you want to go the other way, go there. It's fascinating if you like Turner paintings, and I think you might.
Yeah, I'm not sensing a car chase in that. Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much for that Halloween film review. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Mary Dejeski, Phil Clark, and Judith Flanders. Today's Halloween show was presented by me, Andrew Murderer, produced by Daniel Jack the Ripper Apelli, researched by David Unpleasant and Amanda Lose the first and last syllables of Al Morbida, and our studio manager was Joel Desecrated Church. Next up, after the headlines, our weekly food and drink show, The Menu, presented by Marcus Hippie at 2200 The Monocle Daily. This show returns on Monday at 1800 London time, but for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Have a good weekend.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.